Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Coming home to Wyoming, it still feels like an adventure. It still feels big and wild and raw. There's a lot of these little jewels sitting out there that not a lot of people know about that bring you closer to something bigger than yourself.
Discover why Academy Award-winning director and climber Jimmy Chin still calls Wyoming home, and plan your adventure at travelwyoming.com.
Once upon a time, the British royal family entertained themselves by going to the opera. Now they shock the world by a visit to Oprah. And with that truly terrible pun, courtesy of our producer, I welcome you to a special edition of The Rest is History with me, Tom Holland, and our royal correspondent, Dominic Sambrook. And Dominic, we've decided to have this special edition because, yes, of course, the bombshell news that's come from California, the interview with Prince Harry and Meghan. I guess the idea is that every so often something will happen in the news that has such a kind of shed such an interesting light on the kind of broader sweep of history that perhaps we should just do a kind of guerrilla episode. So that's what we're doing. And I confess it was my idea and you were slightly skeptical about this. So yeah. let me begin
Top
by
Royal
asking
Watcher,
you,
Tom Holland.
Yes. I mean, first up, we're not talking about the rights and wrongs here of, you know, which side we're taking, but more broadly, you as a historian of modern Britain.
Yeah.
Suppose you lived to 100 and you were writing the history of Britain in the 2020s. I'm guessing that you would include this episode. I mean, even now, a day after it, you would say, yeah, this is probably worth a chapter.
I would, I think, because in previous books that I've done, the wedding of Princess Anne, the Silver Jubilee, obviously Diana's wedding, they've all kind of featured. So that, you know, it's always part of the national story, isn't it? The monarchy is woven into the stories that we tell about the country. And that's, of course, why this is so incendiary. And you're right. I mean, even for people who absolutely can't stand the House of Windsor, can't stand the monarchy or royal stories, it's hard to avoid this story because it feels like, you know, it opens up lots of discussions about Britishness, about celebrity, about race, about class, about all these kinds of things, which I'm sure we'll get into.
And I guess also about America, because...
Yeah, well, we did our Americanization podcast, didn't we?
Which went out yesterday. And this, in a sense, is kind of a thing about Americanization. I guess that the royal family had its experience of Americanization in the 30s with the abdication crisis. And that's the kind of the obvious parallel, Wallace Simpson marrying Edward VIII and divorcing. But I mean, slightly different because her Americanness wasn't really the problem, was it? She was the divorcee. That was the issue then.
I don't know that I'd go quite along with that, Tom. I think that being a divorcee was obviously the bulk of the issue with Wallace Simpson in 1936. But I think the Americanness was an element as well. So because she was American, she was seen as a kind of parvenu, as an outsider, as a bit vulgar. I mean, that's always been the sort of British, slightly condescending view of Americans, hasn't it? And, I mean, we were talking in our Americanization podcast about American society heiresses coming to, you know, the sort of Henry James novel characters, these women coming over and getting themselves entitled, I mean, literally, titled British husbands. And Wallace Simpson was seen at the time as the sort of culmination of that story. And obviously, there's a slight element of that with this story as well. I think Meghan's Americanness is key to the kind of culture clash as much as anything.
And I think it's that's why I think this is actually a really fantastic story. Have you come across a book by the former Portuguese Europe Minister, Bruno Massange.
I have seen it, yeah. Eurasia. He writes about Dawn of Eurasia. Is that his book?
Yeah, but his most recent book was on America, and he posits this, I think, brilliant thesis that what's happened between Reagan and Trump is that Reagan kind of brought the glamour of Hollywood and the methods of Hollywood to Washington, but Trump basically he kind of brought Washington into the orbit of mass entertainment. And yeah. Essentially created a kind of fantasy version of America that lots and lots of Americans found more compelling than the reality. And that basically with social media and cable TV and everything, you can basically, as an American, inhabit a complete world of fantasy, and reality barely kind of intrudes. And, you know, both on the left and the right, people construct entire kind of fantasies about what America is. And yeah. In a sense, Meghan is a kind of representative of that, because she's from, you know, she's from the entertainment industry, which historically has been a kind of great motor of Americanization. And she essentially has brought that kind of fantasy idea to Britain. And the idea of becoming a princess, you know, she compared herself to the Little Mermaid. I mean, everything is kind of drawn from the world of movies and TV dramas and melodramas and things like that. And usually when people like that come into the orbit of the royal family, they get crushed by it. Diana would be the obvious example. I mean, she had, yeah. had fantasies about, you know, her prince, Prince Charming, and it all went horribly wrong, and she was crushed by it. But because Meghan comes bringing behind her the heft of this enormous entertainment industry, and more importantly, the ability to see the world through the prism of the entertainment industry, it's run crash into the British variant of that, which is essentially a kind of royal one, which again is kind of steeped in fantasy and kind of incredible tradition. And basically, for the first time, I think the British variant is coming off worse.
Well, I mean, I think it's coming off worse in the battle for international public opinion. There's no doubt about that. But the royal family, the British monarchy doesn't need to care about international public opinion, does it? I mean, there's only one set of public opinion.
It does.
I don't think it does, Tom. I think that's balderdash. I really think that's balderdash, because I think that's judging it by the wrong standards. See, I think that's judging it by the American TV, if you like, your American TV industry standards. I think the British royal family only really has to worry about one constituency, and that is the British. I mean, of course, they've got Australia, Canada, and so on, but it has to worry about the British domestic audience.
But they've also got the Commonwealth, which is hugely important to the Queen. And she was giving a message about that the evening before the interview went out. And that's why the charge of racism is so incendiary, because I think that really does matter. I think it obviously matters in the United States, where it's an absolute lightning rod issue. But I think it does matter for the role that the Queen has played in the Commonwealth. And, of course, very obviously for the role that the royal family plays in Britain as a kind of unifying symbol.
Although there is a really interesting thing about that, Tom. Now, I was thinking about this yesterday, about the racism charge and the race issue with the royal family. And obviously there's been a lot of commentary in the last 24 hours of, particularly from the Guardian wing of the spectrum, saying, well, the royal family is a symbol of colonialism and a symbol of racial prejudice and all the rest of it. And yet, actually, when you look at the last 50 or 60 years, the institution in Britain that's probably been done more than any, I mean, the sort of venerable institution that has been most overtly non-racist is probably the monarchy. I mean, the Queen, in the 50s and 60s, at a time when politicians were, you know, keen to take a hard line on immigration and not to be seen as soft on immigration, the Queen was probably the one public figure who was most often photographed with, you know, black children or greeting crowds in Africa and all that sort of thing. And as you say, the Commonwealth is hugely important to the Queen. And the Queen quite early on she wrapped herself in the robes of, you know, I'm leading a multicultural, multiracial Commonwealth rather than a sort of white dominated empire. You know, she went much further along those lines than the sort of Tory governments of the 50s and 60s would have done. So there's a kind of irony that at the very end of her life, that issue is the one that has sort of come back to dominate the headlines.
Yeah, but that's precisely why I think that the charge is so damaging, because I think that the monarchy was effective as a, a, a symbol of a multicultural, multiracial Britain. I mean, I live in Brixton. I know Prince Charles has done lots of work here, very popular. But the kind of lurking suspicion now, I think that is incredibly damaging. And I think that it does have a kind of international resonance, because if the monarchy, you know, the monarchy is a symbol of Britain.
Yeah.
And if your symbol is seen as kind of morally tainted, then that becomes a problem. You saw that with Trump. I mean, Trump was very damaging his reputation internationally for America, because the presidency likewise is a symbol of the United States. So,
but there's also an element to this, which is just, surely, Tom, it's just merely the latest twist in the soap opera. I mean, we did a thing about the crown. We talked about the crown, didn't we, earlier in the series? Again, your suggestion, Mr. You know, I'm convinced that deep down you have a collection of tea towels with Princess Anne's face on it, because you're constantly coming up with these monarchy-themed podcast ideas. But you know, in a sense, what's happened in the last 24 hours is kind of what, you know, it's what the writer's room would come up with as the latest twist in the drama. I don't think there's an element. I don't think people are walking up and down the streets of Britain in a state of shock, reeling with disbelief that this could have happened. I mean, my sense is that people think, well, this was obviously going to happen at some point. I mean, this was kind of in the script. It's been in the script for the last 2 years, and it was obviously coming. Do you not think?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there were kind of two incendiary charges. And they're incendiary because they have a particular purchase, kind of generationally. So yeah. the issue of racism is one, and the other one is the mental health. That accusation that the royals didn't care about that, and I think that you can see there's a kind of perhaps an element of truth to that, because the Queen is the embodiment of the kind of stiff upper lip, the quiet and sober commitment to duty, never talk about things, just suppress everything, just carry on, keep calm and carry on.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of ideal. And it comes up against another ideal, which is one, you know, I mean, it's basically kind of the millennial ideal, that you should talk about your problems, and that having mental health problems is something that you shouldn't just bottle up, and that talking about them, you know, you should be given a decent audience. And so I think that this is slightly different, because it's like a kind of generational depth charge. I think that people under 40, say, you know, slightly arbitrary dividing line, but I think it matters more to them than it does to people over. And I think that that's reflected in the polling, that people, let's say, of our age are... Yeah. Slightly less sympathetic, inclined to be slightly less sympathetic.
I think there's no doubt that there's a huge generational divide, isn't there?
I mean, my daughter went back to school yesterday, and I sort of asked, you know, do you talk about it? She said, oh, yes. I mean, you know, of course, we're all completely on Harry and Meghan's side. I mean, it wasn't even an issue. So I think that this is and that's why I reckon that I don't want to tell you how to write your book.
Well, you're clearly going to.
but as a way of kind of, you know, and that's what, and you're right, of course.
You're now going to tell me how to make this chapter more interesting, aren't you? I know it. You're going to say, now, Dominic, you should use this as a way into. Thanks for that, Tom. That's very helpful.
But would you not say, as someone who is brilliant at finding ways to kind of shed light on broader social trends, that this is kind of one of the reasons why this is interesting, is that it does shed a light on a kind of what is quite a significant generational sense of evolution?
Yes, it does. And I suppose in exactly the same way as the Diana story did in the 90s. You see, I was thinking about this in the context of the podcast we did about the 90s, where we were talking at the end about kindness and about emoting and about crying and these things as kind of, you know, the 90s felt like a watershed. I mean, if a watershed is not too much of a pun given the crying analogy.
But Diana in particular.
Diana interviewed. So the Diana is the precedent for this. And I think there's definitely an element to which this is the, you know, it's the playing out of a trend that you've seen, you know, you're talking about mental health or the sort of the airing of your linen. You know, the airing of your linen in public feels like something that you do in a post-90s social media age in a way that you might not have done before. But all of that said, there's also a much wider context, obviously, which is that you've got the abdication crisis in 1936. And actually, British history is littered with royal bus stops that are
right, okay,
as incendiary as this. I mean, this is not
possibly even more. But let's have a break. Let's have a break now, and we'll come back perhaps to the longer view.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goal Hanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to our Meghan, The Restless History special with me, Tom Holland, and Dominic Sambrook with me. Dominic, let's put this in the broader sweep of history.
Yes, let's.
So we talked about kind of the American brand of fantasy, but there's a sense in which the royal family is a kind of focus for a distinctively British brand of fantasy because, you know, the Queen is head of state, because she's been anointed and the ritual of anointing. She's the anointed of God. I mean, this goes all the way back to, you know, before the time of Alfred the Great, ultimately to King David and King Solomon. And Queen clearly takes this
really is a long
seriously.
View. Yeah.
And, you know.
Well,
and,
I take
and,
it very seriously,
and,
Tom.
And the Queen rules, you know, in a line of descent from the god Woden. So that is why she rules. The royal family is different. The idea of a bloodline is significant. And that obviously grates against quite a lot of things that people take for normal now. And I guess that one of the reasons that this is an incendiary story is that it does slightly focus people's attention on that.
It does to an extent, but I think people, anyone with a sense of history knows that the royal family, the story of the monarchy has always been attended by kind of hideous familial bust-ups, dynastic rows, marital disasters. I mean, I think about, you know, for all that I read this as this terrible crisis, you think about the coronation of George IV, when his estranged wife was physically barred from entering the church by men with bayonets while the crowd kind of howled around her. And she's so upset. This is Caroline of Brunswick, who he's tried to divorce. He's accused her of adultery. He's campaigned against her in public. She tries to get into the coronation. She's barred. He has this guards not let her in. She gets soaked in the rain. She dies 3 weeks later. And then at her funeral, there's rioting and people are killed in the fighting during her funeral. And the monarchy kind of sails on untroubled into the safer waters of the later 1820s and 1830s. I mean, this is kind of part, it's that crown thing. I think there's always been an element of people enjoying, you know, think about Henry VIII and his wives or Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville. Yeah, there has always been an element of people in that sort of taverns loving the scandal, the gossip. You know, there's that strange place the monarchy has in our collective imagination where it is both, as you say, this sort of sacred institution, but it also always has feet of clay. And sort of lifting the skirts and seeing the dirt beneath, if you like, has always been one of the chief pleasures in life of being either British or English.
But okay, but to come back to this idea that the Queen rules as God's anointed, the descendant of this kind of extraordinary lineage, that's why she rules. And she and the whole royal family are kind of meshed into a distinctive understanding of the church, of bloodlines, ultimately of kind of feudal notions that, you know, have survived kind of amazingly well into the present day. You know, it's kind of like finding an allosaur happily roaming the jungle in Africa or something. But I think that, again, one of the things that's interesting about Meghan's take on this is that to her it's incomprehensible. So two of the charges she brought up, one was that she got married by the Archbishop of Canterbury with Harry in a garden 3 days before.
The
Archbishop of Canterbury gave her a blessing, and she thought that this was a wedding, but it can't be because of complicated details to do with canon law. I mean, does Meghan have any conception of canon law? No. I mean, it's unimportant to her. And likewise, the charge she said that, you know, that that her son wasn't called a prince, I think, because of whatever, racism or whatever. Whereas, in fact, it's because of, you know, complex heraldic laws about who's
who's a prince. Going back to the time of George V. Tell me you don't take these things seriously as I do.
But the point, so the point is that to Meghan, It's incomprehensible and baffling and ridiculous and ludicrous and can only be explained by kind of darker motives. Whereas
she was shocked that she had to curtsy to the Queen, wasn't she? Which I thought was very telling. Yeah.
But if you are a genealogist or a herald for the royal family, or you know, the Archbishop of Canterbury, or you know,
I find it hard to imagine myself as a herald, but
all this kind of stuff matters hugely.
Yeah.
And in a sense, Meghan just kind of sharpens the problem that everyone has who marries into a royal family, because by definition, they are commoners and it's difficult for them. So Kate had it tough. Diana notoriously had it tough. But of course, you know, you've mentioned Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth Woodville, who are also, you know, famous examples of commoners who married into royalty. And it didn't, you know, Anne Boleyn had her head chopped off.
Well, they're slightly different examples. So Anne Boleyn isn't executed because she's a commoner. And of course, Elizabeth Woodville isn't. She doesn't have her head cut off. And now both of them get into trouble, I think, because in those days, for a commoner to marry into the royal family, the commoner arrives with their family. And their family expect a degree of patronage, you know, the Boleyns at the court of Henry VIII. And that means they make enemies. So there are always people in the shadows who are sort of saying, oh, those upstarts, these provincial kind of hayseeds who are now hoovering up all the sort of plum jobs. And that means that the commoner arriving encounters problems. I think the commoner, as it were, arriving now is more of a problem because the commoner you know, you have to know what you're signing up for. So an example of a royal marriage with a commoner that worked very well, and a sort of an amusing one, is Prince Rainier and Grace Kelly, where it's in Monaco, where it's clear that both of them sort of thought of it as a business arrangement, basically. He wanted an American film star. She knew exactly what she was getting into. She wanted to, you know, she thought about it long and hard. She basically had two offers on the table. I think Hitchcock wanted her to be in Marnie, and Prince Rainier wanted her to rule Monaco. And, you know, she had to decide which one to go for, and she went for it very hard-headedly, and she knew precisely what she was getting into. I'm not sure that's true in this instance, and obviously it wasn't true in the instance of Diana. And that's where your fairy tale point is really important, because I think if you're blinded by the fairy tale element and you don't understand the sort of cold hard reality of the institution, then you're going to be in trouble from the very beginning.
Yeah, but I think also looking at it in the broader sweep, the comparison that you can make between Meghan and Diana and everyone and earlier examples of commoners marrying English kings, is that by and large, it's exactly what you say, that if by and large kings marry other royal families, people from other royal families, because the expectation is that they will understand the rules. And they are likewise generally coming from kind of anointed, you know, if they're French or whatever. But at the very least, they are marrying into families that are ruling because of their bloodline. So there's an acceptance that in that sense they are equal. But if they're not, then that kind of unbalances it. And I think you can see, even with Elizabeth Woodville, who Edward IV, it's a love match. It creates all kinds of chaos. And of course, you know, that unleashes all kinds of dynastic feuding. And in fact, you know, if Meghan thinks that Archie's had it bad, Elizabeth Woodville's children get murdered by her brother-in-law, Richard III. So,
that's surely an unlikely prospect.
I think that is an unlikely prospect. But so on the topic of dynastic feuding, there is also an element of that, isn't there, with Harry's taking this, because he's kind of delivered a dagger into the back of his father and brother.
There's so much interesting stuff there, isn't there? I mean, an amateur psychologist, or indeed a professional psychologist, could have an utter field day with the Harry-William relationship. And part of it, Tom, surely, we were only joking about this the other day, part of it is the time-honoured elder brother, younger brother dynamic, isn't it? The dutiful, reliable elder brother and the wayward, reckless. So
in the way my brother has kind of run off and married a comedian, whereas I've played straight and married you. You are the Kate Middleton of history podcasts.
That's exactly how I've always seen myself.
The Meghan of podcasts. But so on that theme, do you have any particular favourite examples of royal sons attacking royal fathers?
Henry the Second, isn't Henry the Second?
Yes, he
falls out with all his children. Don't they all turn against him and are sort of encouraged by their mother?
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
You see, I always feel sorry for him in that story. I think The Lion in Winter. Have you seen The Lion in Winter? All that sort of stuff.
Is that the one with that's all you ever think about, Dick Plantagenet.
That's it. So the producer is sending a text that says Lear, and of course he's quite right, King Lear.
Yeah, although that's not history.
No, that's true.
Can I tell you my favourite?
Yeah, you've obviously got one favourite.
That's why I asked the question.
There must be some fantastic Roman ones.
Yeah, the best ones is the Vikings. Harald Bluetooth, first Christian king of Denmark. Who boasted of joining all the various parts of Scandinavia, which is why Bluetooth technology has the name it does.
Ah, nice. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So interesting detail.
So I genuinely learned something from this podcast for the first time.
Well, there you go. So Harald Bluetooth, founder of Bluetooth technology, like all these kind of Viking kings who convert to Christianity, they only basically do it to make themselves more powerful. Terrifying figure. But he has an even more terrifying son, Svein Forkbeard.
Oh, yes. Isn't he to do with Canute? Is he Canute's father?
Yeah, so he's then Canute's father. So Canute is Harald Bluetooth's grandson. And Svein Forkbeard is impatient, wants his father out of the way, launches an attack. musters a huge fleet of dragon ships. Harold Bluetooth sails out to meet his son. There's a massive great clash. In the middle of it, Harold gets caught short. So he pops off his boat onto an island, pulls down his britches, has a dump, gets shot in the arse.
Wow. And that's it. Is he killed? He's killed. He's killed. What an undignified.
So I think.
And that's what you think Harry wants to do to Prince Charles.
Well, it's not for me to say. I'm not a royal watcher like you, Dominic.
I'm so pleased that this conversation. Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly where all discussions of the Harry Meghan imbroglio should lead to the death of Harold Bluetooth on an island. Johnny Good. Okay. Well, I think we've put this. You know, nothing more needs ever be said about this issue ever again.
Yeah, we've resolved it. That's it, guys. You can move on. Let's talk about something else. Thanks ever so much. We have a talking of moving on. We have a new podcast on Thursday with the historian Katja Hoyer, and that is about the Second Reich. So not the Third Reich, the Second Reich. I hope you'll listen to that and enjoy that. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.